Resolving all these facts, and in trying to establish and correlate an active, vital, spiritual concept in their hearts and minds, Earthlings must find their own solution. Quite likely, in some future day, man will evolve a way of life that will embody not only some of the old spiritual and psychological factors which have been tried and tested, but many new and advanced facts will be added, new at least as far as the majority of the people are concerned. In this spiritually and scientifically integrated philosophy of life, man will find not only surcease from this present day's made race to oblivion, but will find instead a new concept of the continuity of life, and with the Garden of Eden life will come happiness, creativeness and fearlessness. It was intimated in the foregoing pages that it was quite obvious that it would require several trips to gain a comprehensive understanding of the Martian way of life, and that therefore, I would quite likely, from time to time, make similar visits or flights. Since concluding the last pages, Norell has made contact several times and has given or shown me pertinent information regarding several issues which I would like to clear up. In case some of you are wondering, just as I did, what caused his people to go underground and why they do not migrate to some other planet since they have all the necessary craft to do so. Norell explained all this by first saying that Mars was, up until about 100,000 years ago, a planet very similar to the Earth. There was air, water, and an abundance of plant and animal life. The cities flourished on the surface just as ours do. At that time, through their occult science and also with their superior telescopes, they saw, somewhere out in space, a cataclysm take place. One of the giant suns suddenly went berserk, flared up like a nova and then exploded in a terrific blinding flash. Huge chunks hurtled out into space in different directions, each one a smaller, white-hot, atomically burning sun, shooting off great streamers of atomic energies. It was determined by calculations that one of these fiery pieces would pass very close to our solar system. As it was larger than our own sun, it was conceivable that there would be tremendous gravitational pull, besides giving off great energies. It was also determined, as light traveled much faster in space than this huge chunk, that it would pass our solar system. This therefore gave the Martians a grace period for preparation. They had, however, a choice, to stay on Mars or to migrate to another planet far away from this solar system. After a search of the nearby, practical limits of the heavens, it was found that there was no other planet available which would be suitable. So an alternative was decided upon. They could build huge cities underground. During the next 200 years or so, an almost frantic building program was assiduously pursued. We can well imagine some of the problems, the sacrifices, and the labor and research which went into this tremendous project, but it was finally accomplished. In due time, all was snug and shipshape as possible. Buried deep under many feet of rock and earth, in their newly constructed dome-like cities, the people of Mars waited for the final hours. Day by day they watched the white glowing mass of light grow larger and larger. There was no really accurate way by which to measure how close it would pass or just how hot it would be. No doubt many thought it would be the end. Finally the hour struck. Norell stated that for 8 days the planet was rocked, torn and twisted as great forces blasted and ripped the surface. Plant and animal life disappeared almost entirely, except for the few species which escaped by being buried in caves. The air and water too, were largely dissipated or drawn off with the passing nova. When it was over, Mars was decimated and burned to a cinder. Other planets also suffered. On Earth there were great earthquakes and tidal waves. A great continent and civilization, called Lemuria, sank beneath the sea. Great deserts were burned into the surface in places which were formerly beautiful forests and plains. The Sahara and Gobi deserts were two of these. Earth's orbit and axis, or the poles, were also changed. Instead of a circular orbit, Earth was rocked into an elliptical orbit, with the addition of a very slight but definite wobble or oscillation, which it has never lost. Uranus was pushed out into an orbit much further away from the Sun. Neptune suffered a similar fate, although not quite so pronounced. It is conceivable that the other planets were also affected according to their size and position at the time of the passing of this huge celestial atom bomb. No doubt the knowledge of this cataclysm will clear up some of the mysteries of Earth's history which have been puzzling the seekers of truth for many years. Another question might be asked in regard to the Martians' system of time. As nearly as can be determined, they maintain a daylight and dark cycle of days just as we do. This is done by simply dimming the overhead dome lights at regular intervals. A week is about 12 days. There are apparently no months tabulated, but the year is divided into four quarters, something like the seasons. Their sense of time is quite different from ours. They practice none of the hurry-scurry which is so prevalent here. Thus there is no constant clock watching, or the tensions which such a practice produces. Here again is a similarity to the Chinese, that is, there is always tomorrow, a familiar Chinese adage. Not that it should be construed that they are a lazy or indolent race, from it. They are very industrious, but mark each day by their accomplishments and not with the passing of hours. Just in the event that there may be individuals who may take personal resentment, or a wrong view of any comparisons which have been made as to forms of government, etc., for the record let it be said, I consider myself just as much a loyal staunch American as any other citizen. My parents and grandparents were all pioneers and helped carve out of a wilderness what is now known as the state of Utah. Moreover, my views on present-day political systems are comparatively average. As a philosopher and scientist, however, I might point out, as others have, many obvious flaws which are a matter of present-day concern. It is the task of our legislative bodies to anticipate and to circumvent such flaws. The Constitution is, in its entirety, a very wonderful document which expresses very highly evolved concepts of living. Such documents and governments resulting from them are, however, effective to the relative degree in which the so-governed people integrate them. The end result therefore devolves upon each individual so participating. The fact that there are 21 amendments proves the correctness of this reasoning. We must always remember that at no time in life should we ever assume we have reached perfection. We must always visualize an infinite universe in which perfection is only relative. We must not become restless or dissatisfied with what we have. Rather, let us be thankful to our Creator for each daily manifestation of His love and abundance, always secure in the knowledge that He will always so manifest. Our forefathers and those who helped carve out this great nation had such idealism and faith. Because we have countless conveniences which they knew not, we must not lose our initiative to keep pushing back the frontiers of ignorance, fear and insecurity. Our present civilization, good as it is in some respects, leaves much to be desired. It has been the purpose of Narelle, the people of Mars and myself to bring you some understanding of their ways of life, hoping thus to bring about, not only among the nations of the world, but future interplanetary relationships which are harmonious and conducive to a better way of life. We all salute you and wish you infinite love, wisdom and peace. India. Shortly after writing this article there appeared in the /Saturday Review, /on May 28, 1955, an article written by Dr. Robert S. Richardson, astronomer at Mount Palomar, which refers to the findings of the International Committee on Mars, which closed its fourth conference on March 25, 1955. There are several interesting statements made, on which I will comment. Mr. Richardson states the consensus of opinion is that there is life on Mars, or that it could exist. This is at least some progress in the right direction. Also, he is quite correct about the deserts. Most of the surface of the planet is semi-arid wastelands. It is, however, incorrect to say there is no oxygen there. The presence of the green maria, which he called sponge-like algae, proves the presence of oxygen, although in a comparatively rare state. As everyone knows, oxygen is necessary in the breathing cycle of any plant which contains chlorophyll. Oxygen on Mars is about 10% of the density of the Earth's oxygen, as was stated in the aforementioned article. This sponge-like algae is found growing along the edges of the snowbanks and often attains a height of 40 to 50 feet. It dries up with the vanishing of the snow caps and regrows the following spring. What the doctor states regarding water on Mars is very true. It is very scarce and the people of the underground cities take great pains to conserve every gallon of it. As to the temperatures, that is still a matter of conjecture. It is a very tricky business to measure heat over 35 millions of miles distance. Moreover, surface temperatures do not affect the inhabitants of the underground cities, as they are completely pressurized and conditioned with temperatures maintained at a comfortable level. The most surprising part of the entire article was that there was absolutely no mention of the famous canals of Mars. I wonder what happened to them? These canals were for many years a great controversial subject. The photograph in this article does not show them. But this is perhaps explained by the fact that this photo was taken with infrared light film. It may be that the savants at Mount Palomar would like to explain this. It is of questionable value that the writer interjected such a material angle as real estate. It seems it would have been wise to confine the remarks within the domain of science and leave this problem up to some of our great promoters in that future day of landing. It might also be that the Martians would resent our tearing up their planet. It is also probable that in that future day when man does have space travel to Mars, he will be able to take his wife or loved ones along. Landing there will be somewhat like taking a plane to a far-off city on this planet. On arriving on Mars, the spaceship will be taxied into a huge airlock. The passengers will disembark and find hotels and accommodations in a similar fashion as on Earth. Assuming, of course, that such factors as freedom from germ life, health, adaptability to lower rare pressures, etc., have been fully compensated for. It is unfortunate indeed that the astronomers of today take such a dim view of the possibility of life on other planets. They should be in a position to know better than anyone else. Does it not seem a bit preposterous to assume that in all the countless billions of suns, star clusters, galaxies, etc., and their associated planetary systems, that Earth and Mars alone are inhabited? Perhaps we should refer to Jesus of Nazareth when he stated that, "In my Father's house are many mansions." In that distant day when space travel is a reality, let us hope that our men of science are universally schooled in their knowledge of the infinite God and that we will find in this wisdom an integrated philosophy of life, one which will supply our need and an answer to every problem. In that future day, we will have put aside all our petty quibbling over interpretations. We will find God not only in the heart and mind of man but in everything in this material universe. A word about the author. Just 50 years ago in a small town in northern Utah, Ernest L. Norman made his debut into this planet Earth. It was apparent right from the first that he was an unusual child. His mother nearly died in the process of his introduction, because of the abnormally large head. It is said he had the body of an 8-pound child, but weighed over 12 pounds. Before he was hardly two, he was experimenting with writing and long before he went to school for the first time, he was quite familiar with the English language, so much so, he was reading his father's library. His father, incidentally, was a very learned man, of royal Norwegian descent and had degrees in law, psychology, physiology and phrenology. The author was the fifth of eight boys and girls, all strong lads and lassies, and it was quite natural for them to resent having a brother who was so studious. At the tender age of five he constructed his first microscope using the eyepiece section from his father's telescope, and by inserting it in a wooden frame made from a cigar box and a small piece of mirror, he was able to count the hairs on earthworms. At the age of six he performed an unusual and prodigious feat. Using his knowledge of Archimedean laws of fulcrums, levers and rollers, he moved an 8-by-12-foot coal shed containing 1/2 ton of coal over a distance of approximately 200 feet, through an apple orchard and over soft ground to a new and more convenient location. This feat took him about 3 weeks to accomplish and was one which would have taxed the strength and endurance of a strong man. This accomplishment was carefully noted day by day, by his father who would boastingly report the progress made to the townspeople. It was also at this early period of life, that he constructed a rabbit hutch which was vastly superior in design and workmanship to one constructed by an adult neighbor more than six times his age. This he did, using old rusted out, discarded tools. Another time, at the age of seven, he bested his father in an argument, that is, that all energy was electronic. At present he is completely vindicated inasmuch as science today is resolving into this conclusion. During his early teenage years in junior and senior high school, he established several new high watermarks in biology, genetics, science, etc., and won several noteworthy citations as well as attracting some interest from his teachers. It is estimated that at the age of 14, he had a vocabulary of about 60,000 words. It was easy to see then, that this boy, who in winter time read almost continuously or dreamed the summer away watching nature, had not wasted or played his time away as most lads are wont to do. At the age of 17, his family moved to California and temporarily, at least, formal school was finished. But he persisted, even taking night classes in various subjects. At the age of 23, and just before the Depression, he married and remained so for 14 years. During this time, he became very active in radio and electronics. It was his wife who always said they had the best radios in the neighborhood and they were always hand-constructed. After World War II, he devoted himself to his lifetime dream, metaphysics, and became an ordained minister in an occult science church. From the very start, in this work, it became evident he possessed an outstanding clairvoyant development and, during the war years, demonstrated this talent not only in churches and lecture halls, but in almost any place opportunity presented itself and achieved no small measure of fame in this capacity. However, it is his ambition at this time and has been for many years, to fill in the gaps in our scientific and spiritual philosophies of the world, and to set up a new and integrated philosophy of life. With this most outstanding ability of clairvoyance, coupled with a tremendous grasp of scientific knowledge, he is very humble and unpretentious, refusing to attach the stigma of self to whatever comes through the channel of his mind and is ever aware of attunement with the superconscious. On the forehead of the author is a large welt, in a perfect raised circle. This becomes activated at time when he is inspired or attuned, as though it is a necessary factor in making contact, mentally, with the intelligences of other dimensions or on other planets. Another strange phenomenon is the nail holes in the palms of his hands, which appeared physically during a psychic working out with his previous life in Jerusalem and the crucifixion and are most surely points of great interest in showing that he is indeed a most unusual soul, mentally and spiritually, and has reached a very rare, if ever duplicated, state of consciousness through his countless thousands of lifetimes of endeavor in these fields. Many very miraculous healings have come through Dr. Norman. His conscious mind is able to contact the superconscious, which can tune into the past experiences and past lives of the individuals to actually locate and view the experience in a former life which is responsible for the present illness, thus being able to eliminate or neutralize the impinging vortex from the psychic body of the individual by mental and spiritual means. Many wonderful healings and permanent cures have thusly been achieved. The spiritual science of Honorius, which is used, is not one of happenstance or guesswork, but his ability to tap, in a scientific way, the energies of the infinite. Just so surely, those same powers and energies are ever present to keep us well, vital and at peace when we align ourselves into them. Ruth E. Norman.